Matter of State versus Jerome Shaw Jr. Can we please have appearances?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Helm.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
The institution of the grand jury has never been more important. As criminal jury trials become exceedingly rare, put to use in less than 10% of cases by some estimates, the grand jury is the ordinary New Jersey citizen's last remaining consistent and regular contact point with the application of the criminal laws in this state. And in New Jersey, in contrast to much of the rest of the country, the right to a grand jury actually means something. We've enshrined it in our Constitution, and this court has strengthened that right and time again ensured that every grand jury proceeding in New Jersey is conducted with fundamental fairness to the target. My point then, Your Honors, is relatively straightforward, that the concept of fundamental fairness is relevant to grand jury resubmissions. I think that's what the appellate division below concluded. I think when they asked for this court's guidance on what counts and whether or not at some point fundamental fairness is implicated. And I actually think everyone up here, everyone arguing today would agree with at some point fundamental fairness and due process is implicated. We simply disagree about when that point is. And I think the proper time to ask for judicial intervention is after a first no bill. And that's because contrary to what the state may have you believe, a grand jury is not a focus group for the state to try out its evidence and see what works and then come back afterwards when they don't get the outcome that they want. Because the essence of unfairness is trying again and again and again until you get the outcome that you want. And I think in New Jersey, the right to a grand jury and a no bill must be given some sort of respect. So I have 3 points I'd like to make then, Your Honor, with respect to that. First is that I think uncontroversially, this court has the authority and the constitutional mandate to regulate grand juries in this way if it so chooses. It has the authority under its supervisory jurisdiction over criminal procedure in New Jersey to promulgate these rules. Second is that the proper paradigm to evaluate multiple submissions is fundamental fairness. And contrary to the state's position, it's not abuse of discretion. And therefore, this court should look to state versus Abadi in determining that framework. And then finally is that Mr. Shaw's right to a fundamentally fair grand jury process was infringed in this case because of the tripartite procedures, because of not presenting new evidence, and then most egregiously in the third grand jury presentation by the improper expert testimony. So I can spend a few minutes first on this court's supervisory authority. I don't think that's controversial. You know, time and time again, as in Hogan and in
other... Start with the proposition. If there are limits that need to be imposed, why this court and not the legislature as you look at the rest of the nation?
Sure. I think because this court's authority is different than other courts in other states, and this court has taken a more active role that other courts haven't. I think that almost no other courts have Hogan. I think this court was a vanguard when it decided against the federal rule, and it decided not to take the Williams Court's rule that grand juries needed to be presented with exculpatory evidence. And this court's relationship with grand juries in New Jersey is just different than in other states. And the trend across the nation is not only to not regulate grand juries in this way, but the vast majority of states have done away with the requirement altogether. And if New Jersey has decided to enshrine that right in our Constitution, and this court has decided that there must be some fundamentally fair conception over what that process means, lest we eviscerate that constitutional right altogether, I think that's why it's appropriate for this court to do it, because the relationship with the grand jury is just simply different.
So I'll give you an example, a hypothetical.
Sure.
Murder case, 5 eyewitnesses, and we have video from 2 different directions that identifies only 12 grand jurors show up, and for whatever reason, there's a no bill. It's your position in that particular case, the prosecutor has to go before the court in order to get permission for a resubmission?
I don't think it's for this court to decide, of course. I don't think the proper rule is to ask for permission ahead of time. I think, nonetheless, this court can promulgate a rule that a defendant can challenge that if he knows another presentation is going to be made, and he can move to bar it, also afterwards. And that's exactly why the multi-factor test from Abadi is a nice solution to this problem, because there's lots of different things to take into account.
I don't see how Abadi really applies here, because Abadi is a retrial, and all of the things that go into a retrial, the anxiety, the expense, the time, just don't apply to the grand jury. The defendant may not even know that there's a grand jury presentation. There may be no expenditure of money, no anxiety, nothing like the body factors. I just don't see the relevance of those factors.
For sure, Your Honor. I think the answer to that is, of course, it's not as intense as a retrial, and the anxiety isn't to the same degree, but in looking where this court can source the factors that it should apply, I think that's the right example, and that's the right place to look. And that's because that's a paradigmatic case of fundamental fairness in this court, and also because that's also a case in which a trial court has the authority to dismiss an indictment with prejudice when there has been a violation of fundamental fairness.
So you're arguing for this set of considerations in light of the doctrine of fundamental fairness that focuses on whether there's been an unjust and arbitrary action by the state. Do the Abadi factors really address that in this context?
I mean, I think the body factors do address an unjust and arbitrary action by the state. In that case, it was, can you try this person a third time? And here the question is whether or not what the state did at the third grand jury was okay, and if that counts as something that was fundamentally fair. It was, of course, an admittedly odd factual scenario that the reason I'm here before you at all is sort of a case that I don't think happens a lot, but nonetheless, the essence of what a body is asking is they didn't ground it in double jeopardy. They didn't ground it in due process. This court grounded that in this admittedly nebulous concept of fundamental fairness. And as the state below, and I think to a certain extent the state in its brief in this matter, they disclaim any limits on their authority to present at all other than their own ethical obligations or perhaps some abuse of discretion afterwards.
Well, they say the prosecutor has to act in good faith, the prosecutor has to use careful judgment, prosecutor has to refrain from arbitrary action. They
Absolutely.
Say all those things govern them, and I know there's an ethical element to them, but I don't see them arguing that they're just bound by the rules of ethics and nothing more. There is judicial review here.
I'm not sure that was judicial review of a prosecutor's ethical obligations.
No. But there is a standard by which courts can review the decision to resubmit, correct?
Under abuse of discretion?
Yes.
Sure. And I think the reason it should be fundamental fairness is because pointing back to Abadi. Actually, the appellate division in that case said it would have been an abuse of the prosecutor's discretion to resubmit in that case or to try them again. And this court said, no, that's not the framework that we're looking for. We want to evaluate this on fundamental fairness.
The court was pretty clear, though, that it realized it was treading carefully on authority that's typically left to the prosecutor. Your standard would suggest that the court should become more intrusive after the first no bill. Isn't that quite a low standard to suggest to this court in light of Abadi?
Intrusive meaning, is there any room for this court to review at all, or for any court? Is there room for judicial intervention? In that way, yes, it's more intrusive.
But your standard would seem to apply any time the prosecutor had additional or new information that it wanted to use in a second presentation to the grand jury. Unless I'm mistaken.
No, I think that comports with fundamental fairness. I don't think the state should be able to do what it did in this case and have an expert testify at the grand jury that flagrantly violates Kane, that violates Sowell, that violates Reeds. I mean,
wouldn't your position be stronger if you presented the court's role as more of a backup role than the one that you're suggesting after the first no bill?
Absolutely, and I think I want to be clear about what my position is. My position is not that the state has to seek permission to go to a second no bill. My position is there is a mechanism for if a defendant is aware that he can seek to bar the indictment, or afterwards he will be made aware and it will not be an automatic free second presentation. I think that's what separates me from my colleagues up here arguing today. It's not a free second presentation with no constraints whatsoever.
Based on the first presentation, you've looked at the grand jury transcript, correct?
I have.
Do you have a position whether there was sufficient evidence to support the charges in the first grand jury?
I think just as when we don't evaluate what a jury did during a mistrial and we don't try to speculate, the grand jury is a yes or no answer.
No, I'm asking you. Forget about it, because
if you were sitting as a magistrate, as happens in other states, reviewing an information for probable cause, is it there?
After the first Nobel and nothing else has happened? I think I have to say there was likely probable cause there for the first no bill, but it's important to remember that's not what happened in this case.
So since we know that presentations are typically abbreviated in a grand jury setting, and that grand juries, for whatever reason, can sometimes make significant errors, why isn't the ACLU's position a more sound one than jumping in after the first no bill?
I would just like to push back that it's jumping in after the first no bill. It will be exceedingly rare in which, after the first no bill, a second bill is not allowed. It will be exceedingly rare, but my position here, it shouldn't be impossible. Ebadi said there are numerous factual situations, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And certainly, there are instances in which there are political considerations, and that would be why we should allow a second bill in this case. In other instances, we can say that if the purpose of a grand jury is to present prevent vexatious prosecution against someone, if there was a case in which it actually was vexatious, regardless of whether it meets the probable cause standard, maybe there's a situation in which somebody was investigating a political rival and they wanted to institute
a
grand jury proceeding against that person.
But in a case like this, after a second presentation, if the evidence clearly establishes probable cause, like, what's wrong with that?
I think
what's wrong? Even if it's the same evidence, might it not suggest that first grand jury was just off, or that there may have been untoward reasons why the grand jury did not return a true bill?
I think it's important to keep in mind, Your Honor, in many of this court's cases, there was enough evidence for probable cause. In Murphy, I don't think probable cause for the indictment was the problem. It was that the state knew that two of the grand jury witnesses worked for the victim. It was an insurance fraud case, and they worked for insurance companies.
That's a different issue. That goes to the fairness of the presentation.
And that's exactly my point. Can you have a free second presentation? It's as if the first one never happened. And to Mr. Shaw, what is the value of that first grand jury presentation if its outcome can just completely be ignored and the state can try again?
It may not. There are many cases where there are no bills, probably most, where the state just doesn't go back for representation. It is probably, and I don't have statistics before me, it's probably a rare case where they actually represent. Am I mistaken?
No, and with all due respect, I think that's because when there is a no bill, it's often because the prosecutor asks for one, because they're not interested in proceeding with the case. So I think that if the statement in Engel or the statement in Hart that, you know, the grand jury is not to be this play toy of the prosecutor, and it's actually an arm of the court, and it's exercising a quasi-judicial function, even if the meaning of that no bill is very slim, it's still relevant to what goes on afterwards. And although there was no presentation, there was no motion to dismiss the indictment after the first no bill, after the second one, we saw a presentation in which the state came back, they gave the exact same presentation, except this time they let the guy slip out that Mr. Shaw had a weapons conviction.
So let's take this case. You conceded that the first presentation had probable cause?
I don't think that's what this court is evaluating today.
No,
I think were there...
Just answer my question.
Were there a motion to dismiss the indictment?
Apparently one member of the court is evaluating that.
No, go ahead. No,
were there a motion to dismiss the indictment after the first no bill, it likely would have been denied.
Okay, so you get notice of the no bill, and now you go before the court, and the prosecutor argues, look, something really happened, untoward. First grand jury, look at the transcript. There's sufficient probable cause here, and I'm asking your permission to present again. Under those circumstances, would the court be abusing its discretion in permitting a second presentation?
Two answers to that.
Go ahead.
I don't think that the state has to go beforehand and ask for permission to present again. The question is, after there's a no bill, is a defendant entitled to say this no bill is relevant to the court's analysis in determining whether the prosecutor abused the discretion? It's relevant. It is a piece of information that matters because the grand jury matters. That's different than the state asking for permission. Second of all, I think there is authority to look at this first grand jury presentation and say they were really skeptical of the state's evidence. If we look at what they're asking here, they were like, why are we considering these things weapons? Why are we saying that someone who has a clipper in their car, if they're going to go burglar, why is there any reason to think they were going to use that against a person? And so they're skeptical of the overcharging in this case. They're not sure why one 10-second interaction with the police or one stop has suddenly given rise to 10 charges against Mr. Shaw here, why there's all these counts. They're asking that types of thing. And they're really skeptical of the state's evidence in terms of the weapons specifically, why we're thinking of these as weapons for a lethal purpose rather than something we're going to be used for burglar tools. And I think the grand jury is entitled under that circumstance to say, we think the state went way over the line here and we're throwing it away. That doesn't mean it's impossible for them to come back. But what they shouldn't be allowed to do is add flagrant 404B evidence in the second grand jury presentation to try to secure the indictment. And what they shouldn't be allowed to do is do that again in the third grand jury presentation and then also have this bogus expert who's presenting evidence that they full well know cannot be admissible at trial.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. If the first is a no bill and then the second one results in an indictment and you come before the court and the court believes that it could have gone either way, do we now go to a third, 2 out of 3? Because you have one indictment with the same evidence, one that wasn't. So what should the court do in that point? Say, okay, we'll go 2 out of 3?
It's hard to say what the court should do when we're taking this multi-factor test and every fact of every case is going to be different. In this case, did the state do something untoward to secure that second indictment? I think yes. They allowed him to say
Untoward. The first one's presented a certain way for whatever reason. The jury no bill and prosecutor, just like you believe that there was sufficient probable cause. So they go to a second one, now the jury indicts. And you come before the court to appeal and say, go back to the first. The court has two. So what does the court do at that point? Throw its hands up and say,
I think it has to compare how the evidence was different the first time. To the extent maybe this court would decide it's relevant to look at the votes. I think it's important, though. Every decision is going to be different, and that's why we give trial judges this kind of discretion. The question is, should you be able to come to the court and ask to dismiss the indictment, and the state says, oh, the no bill, it doesn't matter. It's not like it even happened. It's irrelevant to this court's analysis. That's the simple, straightforward point I'm trying to make, Your Honors, is that that's a determination by at least one quorum of a grand jury that this wasn't enough.
What are you saying, looking at the votes? So we're going to add up the number of votes to indict on one and then the second one and see if there's a majority?
I think no, because I think the important thing is that we don't, in a petit jury, we don't look into that for sure. We don't look into the deliberations.
So what did you mean by referring to the looking at the votes?
I'm saying there are lots of opportunities for this court to say that they could have the information that they want to have. That means this court could say that. I don't think that it should. I'm just nonetheless saying that's information that's out there because it's a multi-factor test, and every party up here has pointed to different factors that trial judges should be using to determine whether or not a no bill should be allowed.
You don't really rely on the second grand jury presentation here because the judge tossed that under some so-called multiple presentation rule.
Right.
That doesn't factor into your analysis. You think something should have happened after the first grand jury, correct?
It factors into the analysis in terms of whether there was misconduct in obtaining that, because I think allowing for the testimony that the target of the investigation or that Mr. Shaw had a criminal history and they said weapons violation in front of the grand jury, I think that factors into what the state was trying to do to secure the indictment.
That wasn't the judge's ruling in this case, of course.
No, I don't. There wasn't. There was no ruling on the second one at all. There's no order from which to appeal. There's no.
The trial court dismissed because of a violation of a quote-unquote multiple presentation.
I'm not even sure you can categorize it as a dismissal because there is no order of dismissal. She just threw it in the garbage. I don't think that...
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Can you go to trial on an indictment thrown in the garbage?
I don't know. It's admittedly an odd and unfortunate circumstance in this case. That's why I think the second presentation, for the most part, needs to not factor in, except for the fact that Mr. Shaw had to undergo it, and to the extent he was aware of it, he knew that there was a presentation, and it kept him in limbo longer, waiting for a valid indictment.
You acknowledge that courts have the power to correct mistakes by the grand jury. If the grand jury returns an indictment where there isn't a prima facie case, you expect the court to dismiss that indictment, correct?
If there's not sufficient evidence?
Yeah.
For sure.
So this is the other side of the coin. For some unexplained reason, let's say there's plenty of probable cause or overwhelming probable cause, and for some unexplained reason, the grand jury doesn't indict. The question is, can there be a correction by a second presentation,
I think even
with the same evidence?
It's the nature of the system in which we entrust these decisions to individual, everyday people. When a jury comes to a decision that the judge doesn't agree with, there's not always avenues for that to be overturned or not. And of course, there is a mechanism for judicial review, but there's a reason we don't just have prosecutors present information and say that we think there's enough evidence. And there's a reason we don't just ask trial judges if they think there's enough probable cause here. We have to, if we entrust that decision to 23 individual people every day of the week or a couple days a week in 21 counties around New Jersey, it has to mean something.
Can comment on this, if you would. If there's review at some point in time, in order to guard against unjust and arbitrary action, which is at the core of the fundamental fairness doctrine, it would seem to make sense that you would consider whether there was misconduct by the prosecutor.
Yes.
Whether there was sufficiently strong evidence, evaluate the strength of the evidence, and whether there was new evidence. Why are any of the other factors that have been bandied about in the fine presentations we've gotten relevant?
I mean, I think that basically covers the Abadi factors for the most part. I think it's important to think the number of times there's been a no bill before is relevant in to the sort of getting to the core of what that fairness, fundamental fairness means. If there were five no bills and then this was the sixth presentation, I think every single person on this court would feel differently about how that presentation would happen, and a trial judge would feel differently. So I do think that the number of prior, if we take mistrials in Abadi to mean number of prior no bills, I think that's a relevant consideration. And then essentially that's all of the conduct that's been covered under the Abadi factors except for the character and complexity of the evidence. And I think that's subsumed in what Your Honor just spoke about, whether there's a judicial evaluation of this evidence. And it's also, is it a complex case? Was it a multi-witness, multi-day grand jury presentation that we have some doubt that maybe the grand jurors were not able to grasp it? Here, it could not be a more simple case. It was a half an hour presentation, maybe. There was one witness, and it's simple conspiracy and attempt to commit burglary. And I think that also highlights the outrageousness of using an expert witness in this third grand jury presentation.
Well, it's not outrageous, but because in a typical case involving burglary tools, an expert will come in and explain how particular tools are fashioned to be used in burglaries.
Right.
I'm not saying that in this presentation that the expert didn't go beyond.
Right.
But in grand juries, we permit plenty of things that we would never permit before a pettit jury, including wholesale hearsay, right?
For sure. I think there's a couple of points to that. First, I would say this expert went well beyond what would ever be allowed for burglary tools. He testified what the significance of a ski mask was. He said when someone's trying to hide their identity, they put a ski mask on. And he testified to what it would mean to wear dark clothing at night. He said, if you're trying not to be spotted.
I don't even see what's wrong with that.
That violates Sowell. This court's decision in Sowell said, we can't tell the jury that when you put some drugs into a potato chip bag, you're trying to conceal the evidence. As I believe in the Chief Justice's opinion, he said, the nature of criminal activity is that, of course, they're going to try to conceal their activity.
But why a person would wear black clothing, okay, at 1 o'clock in the morning, and there would be a ski mask, okay, along with tools that look as though they're adapted to a burglary.
Is that outside the ken of the jury? of anyone in this room why you would wear dark clothes at night? I don't think we need an expert to be explaining that and giving the imprimatur of a state's witness.
It's beyond common knowledge to explain why tools that are brand new that could then not be compared to prior incidents have significance?
With that respect, no. But I think that there was that 10% of this testimony was maybe allowed under this court's different cases, and 90% of it was just giving the evidence, the imprimatur of a state's, not only a state's witness, but a state's expert witness. And that's exactly what this court said in Kane it was worried about. And to go back to your other point about whether we allow this type of thing at a grand jury versus a trial, this court's cases make clear that if we're worried about whether the decision-making function of the grand jury has been compromised, that's when we get concerned. And that's exactly what this court said in Kane about using an expert testimony to explain that they had intent, to say that in Sowell, when you put drugs into a potato chip bag, that means you're trying to hide the drugs.
We, for better or worse, we permit a single person to go before the grand jury with a whole bunch of eyewitness statements and just read them to the grand jury, okay, which would be a complete denial of the confrontation rights of a defendant at a trial.
For sure, and the difference there, Your Honor, is that with hearsay, there's an obvious expediency rationale to that. We don't want these to turn into mini trials. We don't have a right to confrontation at the grand jury. And so it makes sense that we relax those kinds of rules at the grand jury. It doesn't make sense that we would relax the Kane rule. As the appellate division found in Grant, in which the state allowed the defendant to testify in shackles in front of the grand jury, they said, no, 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 no. We wouldn't allow this at trial. It's the exact same kind of thing that we're impermissibly impinging on the grand jury's ability to make its decision.
But Grant was an extreme situation. Yeah, are you here making the argument that everything that applies in terms of Kane's limitation in the Kane case, it was obviously intent to distribute.
Right.
That those apply as much before the grand jury and in the same manner as they do at trial.
Yes.
That's your argument.
Yeah,
We have a limited grant of cert here, don't we?
Yes.
And it's limited to the fact that there were three separate grand juries. No? Do we get to this issue?
We get to it because under the factors that I've asked this court to adopt, one of them is prosecutorial misconduct. And I would say it's misconduct for the state to present a witness that they know would never be able to sustain a conviction at trial.
We understand your argument. Let's take a break. I don't think we're going to get through your argument in 2 minutes.
And
let's take a break. We'll come back. We'd love to hear from you. We may have some questions to keep you up even longer.